From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, one of the country's leading neuroscientists, Antonio Damasio, joins us in studio. We'll discuss the nature of consciousness and self with him, as well as how evolution works on the human mind. His newest book is Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. One of the world's leading neuroscientists, Antonio Damasio, is professor of neuroscience, psychology, and neurology at the University of Southern California, where he also directs the Brain and Creativity Institute. His books include Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain, The Feeling of What Happens, Body and Emotion and the Making of Consciousness, and Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. And his newest book is Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain, and we're going to talk with him about that and all sorts of matters related to consciousness this hour. He joins us in studio. Delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Well, let's start off with maybe getting some kind of working lay definition of what consciousness is. It is, among other things, well, it is pretty much a biological process or a biological entity, and that's where we should begin?
Yes, that's probably a good way of beginning, or at least it's also a good way of ending there. We have, looking at it as a biological process, certainly from the point of view of a researcher like myself, is essential. And it is if you see it in a biological perspective, you have a better chance, I think, first of all, to understand how the brain puts it together, but also to understand why on earth do we have it? Why on earth did natural selection preserve this incredible, very rich process over millions and millions of years?
Well, in fact, your book brings in the evolutionary process as an integral part of how consciousness evolves. How do we go, though, from consciousness to mind and self? And that's really sort of the trajectory that you're working with, isn't it?
Right. In this case, we actually go from mind. We go from a non-mind to mind to self. And once self arrives, you have consciousness. The title "Self Comes to Mind" is very intentional. I think it sounds well, but that's not the issue. The issue, you could paraphrase it by saying that this is about the moment physiologically in which a process of self is added to a process of mind, and therefore you get a conscious mind. So it's the addition of the self. And as you have certainly found out in the book, the idea is that, we can have, and we have that evidence actually from studies of patients, we can have situations in which we have no consciousness whatsoever. You can have situations caused by neurological disease in which you have a mind but do not have a self. And when you have a mind and do not have a self, your consciousness is not normal. So it is that addition of the self that produces sort of the last stretch into the consciousness goal. Now, one thing that is very important when we deal with any definition is to realize that we can take a human perspective. And, of course, if we start talking about your consciousness or mine, we end up with something extremely complex, multi-layered, very rich, and very flexible, which can waver from moment to moment throughout the day, depending on the demands of the moment. But then if you talk about animals, non-human animals, you also have to consider that they have minds and consciousness. At least I suspect that most of them do. And then the process is of the same kind, but not necessarily of the same intensity, and it does not have the same wealth of our process. So it's extremely tricky to produce consciousnesses, to produce definitions of consciousness that would fit all of these demands, in 1 second or in one phrase.
And normally, E.O. Wilson, notwithstanding, you normally don't think of, say, ants as having consciousness, but they do.
Yeah, Well, yes, yes. You can. You know, whenever you know, mind and consciousness are about a fundamental problem, which is the problem of being alive. If an organism is alive, that organism has a very important problem to face, which is how is life going to be managed within the walls of this organism? How are energy sources to be procured? How is an energy source going to be incorporated, and how is it going to be transformed? What do you do to deal with predation and threats from the outside, and to deal with opportunities? Now, of course, if you are a bacterium or a single cell, like say an amoeba, your problem is going to be managed in terms of the instructions that come from the genome that is inside that small little body. In our case, it's different, and in the case of many other species that have acquired brains in between, it's very different, because we gradually get the ability to manage life in a more complex environment, within a more complex organism, in a variety of ways. So consciousness and mind and consciousness together are a possibility of managing life with some optimization. You have a chance of managing life better. And you need to have minds and you need to have consciousness because, as I said, the organisms get more complex, environments get more complex, and so what works for an amoeba, what works for bacteria in their small ecological niches will not work for us, will not work for many other species in between.
We're talking to the author of Self Comes to Mind, Antonio Damasio. All of this is really brainwiring, as you point out. I mean, it all goes back to, in fact, not the cerebral cortex, like many people assume, but the stem of the brain.
Correct. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the points that I'm making in Self Comes to Mind is that we have spent, and justifiably, quite a lot of time thinking about the cerebral cortex, which is sort of a pinnacle of brain evolution in humans, of thinking of it as the source of consciousness. And one can understand why people did that. They said, well, you know, we have this incredible brain, we have this incredible product called the conscious mind. Why not think that the top of the brain and the conscious mind are together, and that it was that cortex that generated that conscious mind? And in general, it has been thought that lower structures of the brain, like the brainstem, are low and humble and unable to provide the lofty product that we call consciousness. And what I'm defending in Self Comes to Mind is that while it is certainly the cerebral cortex that allows you and me to write books, for example, and to be able to have this conversation and to be able to appreciate the world in very fine detail and to reason and deliberate and all of those wonderful things, the cerebral cortex will have the lion's share of that process. It is also true that the cerebral cortex wouldn't do a thing if it would not be animated by activity that comes from a brain stem, and which, lo and behold, we share with reptiles and fish.
That's why you can call somebody reptilian and really be literal about it. But
absolutely,
feelings come from the brain stem, really.
Absolutely. And I think one of the main proposals in Self Comes to Mind is that we have a kind of feelings, which I call now primordial feelings, which originate in the brainstem and are simply serving notice that, look, here is a living organism. Here is existence. And that existence is there. It's a pure, unvarnished, unembellished feeling, and it is not being prompted by something from the outside world. It's not being prompted by a thought. It's being prompted purely and simply by representations, very rich representations of the living organism, anywhere in the range from pain to pleasure. And it's telling you this is experience. Now, of course, if it's telling that to a lizard, the lizard is not going to care. It's just going to have that experience. If it's telling that to me and to you, then we're going to care, and we're going to elaborate lots of things on top of that. But we have that level, that reptilian level, inside of ourselves.
So we evolve mind first, and then evolve the possibility of knowing we have a mind.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, and I think it's quite. Again, if we go to the let's take the example of reptiles. Do they know that they have a mind? I think that would be pretty far-fetched to conclude. I think that there is an existence there, and there is a direct experience. So there is a mind and experience, and there's a sort of budding sense of self. With us, it's different. With us, we know we can reflect. So we have a sense that there is a mind. We have this process which you could describe as a process of witnessing. We carry, we fabricate an internal witness to the fact that we are alive and that we are interacting with others and with the physical environment.
So how does the brain construct a mind and make the mind conscious?
Well, with multiple steps, the key step in the constructing of the mind is the making of maps.
Like verbal maps and so forth?
Verbal maps and, before that, sensory maps. For example, right now I am making a map of you in my visual cortex. So there is I'm mapping shapes, I'm mapping depth, I'm mapping color.
You were at Google yesterday. Is it a Google map?
Well, Google maps are maps, and they are, in fact, of the same kind. So what you have is a topography. It's putting together signals in basically in a two-dimensional space. You're making maps of my voice right now.
Which has, unfortunately, some laryngitis.
Which has laryngitis, for which I apologize, but that's it. And we are making maps, for example, of the fact that we are both sitting in chairs, and there is somatic information about how we are sitting, whether we lean back or forward or touch the table or what have you. So the mind is made up of a procession of such maps, generally coming from more than one sense. So right now, in this case, we have maps that are visual, auditory, somatosensory, olfactory, not quite gustatory because we're not eating or drinking, but we could have that too. And that flows in time, and that is in of itself experience. What is interesting is that on top of those maps, you can create something a little bit more crisp, which is related very specifically to your own unique organism. And the maps of your own unique organism, let's put it in lay terms, your body, those maps are going to be the ones that give you the essence of the sense of self, because self is about being in a body, being in a body, and having that body be the target of all of these different sensory stimulations out of which you're going to generate experience.
Now, at one point in your book, you say the body has a mind of its own, and you also say that the body is the foundation of the conscious mind. And
yes.
So the old idea about body-mind holistic notions are prevalent here or meaningful?
Well, there's a lot of truth to them. In fact, I think that while, of course, as a neurologist and neuroscientist, I insist on great amounts of knowledge about the brain, about the nervous system, the fact is that the divisions between brain and body and the divisions between nervous system and non-nervous system are somewhat artificial. In fact, one of the suggestions that I have in the book is that at the level of the brainstem, in a way, body and brain get sort of confused. That's the way it has to work. And let's not forget that the brain is made of cells. They're called neurons. The principal group of cells are neurons, but they are living cells like the rest of the living cells in our body. They're just specialized in certain ways. They have the possibility of producing signals of a different kind. They have the possibility of hooking themselves up to construct networks. But in a way, they are an extension of the body, and they are part of the body, and they're ruled by the same rules of other cells. In other words, they're born, they need to be maintained, they have a metabolism, they have a little nucleus inside that governs them, and if things don't go right, they die. And there they are, our neurons, which are the source of our mind. But they don't exist outside. I mean, there was this old image that comes from philosophy of the brain in a vat. And there was this old idea that philosophers would ask, well, could it be that we could take a brain, put it in a vat, and the brain would still have a mind? And some people, actually, you'll be amused, some people would say, yes, probably, it will have a mind. And of course, it wouldn't have a mind at all, because what is going on in the brain is informed by signals from the body and is constantly the result of an interaction with the body. The brain only makes sense as a high-level governor of body activity. And it came into being in the history of evolution when it was too complicated to manage a very large, you know, cumbersome body without having a higher instance that would be able to control certain mechanisms and to coordinate the activities of the rest of the body. That's the reason why we have brains. We don't have brains to compose Mozart sonatas or to paint Picasso paintings, although we have come to do that, which is pretty nice.
I'm wondering about the kind of statements about people like Bill Clinton, you know, that where his brain is located, a certain organ in his body, that sort of thing. I mean, it takes on a whole different meaning when we talk about it in this vein. I'm also wondering about the self here, because you talk about the proto-self and then the core self and the autobiographical self. I mean, you've
Correct.
Got these divisions.
Let's
figure out what we're talking about here when we talk about self. And because when I think of self, I think of the existentialists talking about a protean self, a self that's constantly changing.
Right. And of course, you know, the big problem with these words, you know, we obviously need to stick with an old vocabulary, otherwise nobody's going to make sense of what one is saying. And at the same time, the old vocabulary is full of all these trappings. So self, for example, very often when people talk about being self-conscious, of course, they mean something completely different.
Or self-absorbed or self-obsessed.
Exactly. And so those terms that I introduced to talk about self serve notice that we're talking about a very layered process. And you mentioned proto-self, core self, and autobiographical self. Well, in all of us humans, we have all these three levels operating very richly, and the autobiographical self is extremely distinctive. That's the one that allows you and me to have an identity, to have a personality, and it has something to do with our past history and with our anticipated history. So right now, both of us know that there are a number of things that we have been in our lives, and there's certain things that we plan to do, for example, for the holidays.
Forgive me, I'm thinking about a wonderful line of William Butler Yeats, memories are old identities.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's very interesting because they're not only the old identities, but also the anticipated identities, which is, I think, a very distinctive point about humans. For example, I am convinced that a chimpanzee or a monkey or a dog, for that matter, have an autobiographical self. But that autobiographical self is not only simpler than yours or mine are, but it's also devoid of a complex sense of the future. I think it's less rich in terms of the past. There will be less details. There's less narrative of the past. But also, there's not the anticipated narrative of the future, which you and I do all the time. When we are in downtime, quote unquote, we are thinking about what we're going to do, what we're going to do for the holidays, what we're going to do next year, what is your next book project or mine or my next research. And I'm worrying right now, there are two big research projects in my lab that I've been worrying about and that I need to go and do something for the continuation. All of these things are in my anticipated future. And The interesting thing is that they're there and they're committed to memory as anticipated future. It's what I like to call memories of the future, which sounds absurd, but it's not.
Well, it makes perfect sense. Also, I think of another poet named James Dickey who talked about the heaven of animals because they don't have this anticipation, which means they don't have the anxiety over the future.
Exactly. So this is something that is both, I mean, if the plans we're making are enjoyable, it's wonderful. If the plans we are formulating include things that are less than good, it's also a torture for human beings. I mean, you always have this effective double sword in having, which is a consequence of having this very rich autobiographical
and
self.
Cognizance of mortality.
And cognizance, absolutely. You know, we would not. You know, it's one of the things that consciousness does to us, and that I think is responsible for a lot of the sociocultural evolution of human beings, is that it both lets you know about pleasures, but it lets you know very keenly about losses that are induced by, for example, death, separation, and so on. But so this high level of self, the autobiographical self, I don't think it's uniquely human, but it is uniquely human in the wealth that it has attained, in the riches that it has, which are, of course, strengthened by the fact that we have language, which allows a double coding of everything that is happening non-verbally. But the other two levels below that, the core self, is something that I think we share with any animal that has a brain. And then you have this proto-self, which we probably share with animals that have very, very simple brains, not even equipped with the cerebral cortex, even not capable of doing images. And they still will have this sort of representation of existence going on at that moment. So I think that what we need to realize is that we share with animals this organization, and they will have sentience. They will have a basic sense of being alive and operating in terms of that. This is all extremely influenced by emotion and by feeling, which is something that tends to be forgotten in the world of cognition. People very often think only about ideas, about reasons, about logic, and it is forgotten that we are emoting and feeling creatures. And that is, in fact, the core of our beings.
We think of reason largely, I suppose, because unlike animals, there's a deliberate process often, or there's a process of going through rational deduction,
right.
Logic, and all of that.
Yeah, but of course, even that process is largely influenced by
emotion.
By emotions.
Yeah.
And in a way, the interesting thing is that these distinctions that became actually very marked in the 20th century between reason and emotion are quite exaggerated, because in fact emotions were extremely reasonable. Emotions are very rational ways of coping with a certain class of problems that is shared by a species.
We're coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number, and we're talking to Antonio Damasio. His new book is Self Comes to Mind. You can join us. In fact, I invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the conversation. We welcome your phone calls again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send us an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. We'll continue talking about the mind, consciousness, self, and all that and more when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Antonio Damasio, who asks the primal question and has answers to it in his new book, a question that has pretty much occupied humanity since well, language allowed us to ask it. What is consciousness? His new book is called Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain, and it's an investigation of how new discoveries in neuroscience can actually shed light on the evolution and emergence of the conscious self. Self Comes to Mind is subtitled Constructing the Conscious Brain. And again, Antonio Damasio is professor of neuroscience at the University of Southern California. We're going to go forthwith to your calls and emails and bring you, our listeners, into this. But just talking a little bit off air about something Professor Damasio calls sociocultural homeostasis, and that certainly plays a major role in our conversation here this morning.
Absolutely. So we really have two kinds of homeostasis, or life regulation, for short or for long. One is the kind that we inherit and comes in our genes, and that organizes, for example, our metabolism, organizes our blood circulation, our immune system, and so forth. That is basic homeostasis, basic life regulation. Then we have another level, which I call sociocultural, which has to do with the instruments of culture that we were able to generate, and that we were able to generate quite recently. When you think about basic homeostasis, it goes back millions and millions of years in species like ours. When you think about sociocultural homeostasis, we're talking about, at most, an order of tens of thousands of years, and certainly an accelerated sociocultural homeostasis in the past 10,000 years or so after agriculture developed, and then in the past 5,000 after writing was developed and it allowed us to have an external instrument of memory. And what are the instruments of sociocultural homeostasis? Well, moral systems, religious systems, social and political organization, economies, science, technology,
values.
The arts, the values that are included in the moral systems. So these are all, they're normally described as different developments in our culture, but they are in fact all of the same form, and they all aim directly or indirectly at the same goal, which is to manage life more efficiently and manage life not only at the individual level, but at the social level, so that it permits groups and the individuals in those groups to survive better. And it is very interesting that once you have, I think that we could not have sociocultural homeostasis without being conscious, and in fact without being very self-conscious, having that level of consciousness that I call autobiographical self. Once you do that, then you have the possibility of appreciating the great plight you're in, and you have the possibility of responding to that with a variety of correctives. And whether the corrective is going to be through art or through the invention of a religious system or through the invention of rules and regulations for public behavior, it doesn't matter. It is always aimed at the regulation of the individual within the group and of the group, so that it permits better survival, and eventually it permits survival with well-being, which is, of course, what we all want.
There's also a concept, I do want to get to our callers just in a moment, Will, but that you call genomic unconscious, and this sounds to me very much like Jung. I don't know if it's intentional on your part.
I think there are levels there that connect with Jung and also with Freud. We have within our system, within our brains, within our biology, we have certain very, very powerful levels of organization and goals and routines. And I talk about the genomic unconscious in relation, for example, to literature. There is no question that there are certain characters, there's certain situations that recur.
We call them archetypes, yeah.
Absolutely. And so whether it is the plight of Hamlet and the relations of Hamlet with his parents or and his uncle, or whether it is the situation of Ulysses, it doesn't really make a difference. Or Anna Karenina, for that matter, or Madame Bovary. All of these characters represent something very powerful that we immediately recognize. And the reason why the plays of Sophocles or of Shakespeare or more recent books in the French and Russian novel have become so important in our discourse is because they represent these archetypes. They represent the situations that go back to how our brain is organized. Otherwise, they would never have emerged as instances of art.
Does that mean there's a collective unconscious for different races and different people and different tribes? Because to some extent that connects dots to Jung too.
Yeah, I've never given much thought to that question. I suspect not. I suspect there are going to be differences of surface, but there are certain fundamentals of organization.
Because the brains are too similar. Yeah.
Because the brains are too similar. So the chances are that given the same fundamental biology with the same reflection on brain organization that biology provoked, it would be very strange if we would get very, very, very different organizations of the product, the end product.
We'll bring our callers in. We'll go first to you, Rashad. Good morning.
Thank you. Two questions. The first one is, when does a fetus and a child develop the sense of self and self-consciousness? And the second question is, when does the professor ever think that artificial intelligence and or robots will ever get the sense of self and self-consciousness and being aware?
You begin with two easy questions.
Two easy questions. That's all so simple to answer. Thank you. They're wonderful questions. The first, I really cannot tell you when consciousness in the full sense develops in a fetus. I actually don't think it's there in the fetus. I think that there is a beginning of the organization. They're the beginnings of the proto-self level. But it will only be after birth that you advance towards the level of the core self.
And it's definitely not in embryonic stem cells, though, is it?
No. Definitely not. Not to worry there. And of course, an autobiographical self is unlikely to develop before age 2. So it's a very gradual development. But if we believe, as I do, that the proto-self is organized on the basis of representations of the body at the level of the central nervous system, then chances are that the fetus is on the way to developing the beginnings of that. Why? We know that, for example, in scans, brain scans of newborn, not exactly day one, but after a few weeks, there are already representations, there are already signs of activation of the parts of the brain that normally represent the body. So it's something that is a budding sense of body representation. So I think the proto-self could be beginning its representation there. But consciousness in the sense that the caller and I are conscious right now, I don't think it's there in the fetus at all, and I don't think it's there even in the newborn in the sense that we're talking.
You also want to know about artificial intelligence.
Right, and that question I hope I can give a better answer, and it's very interesting and a very important question. I would suspect that, in fact, I would say more than suspect, I can tell you that I think that robots properly designed can have a consciousness. In other words, I'm going to make a little bit of humor with it, if you don't mind. If you want to take Antonio Damasio's neural conception of consciousness, if you take the parts of the brain with which I propose to build consciousness in humans, and if you find ways of building with an engineering device equivalent to those in a robot, I think you will end up producing a conscious robot. Now, what is not clear, if you just say that, is whether or not that robot is conscious in the same way that you or I or my interviewer are. And I would say definitely not. It is going to be a different consciousness. The robot is going to be able to have some kind of quote-unquote perception of its body. And by the way, it's essential that that robot have a body and have a body that can be representable in whatever will be the simulacrum of a brain in that particular robot, but it will not be the same body that you or I have right now. It's not flesh-based, and that makes an entire difference, because when you and I have consciousness, we have consciousness that is in mind that is built on this very wet stuff called biology, this messy stuff called living cells aggregated in tissues and systems forming an organism. Now, what is so particular about all of these tissues and cells is that they're all individually subject to a life risk, or if you want, a death risk. When you think about your robot, which you're probably going to build out of steel and silicone and whatever alloy you prefer to use, you're not going to have the elements of that physical structure built with the same hardware. And in us, hardware and software end up being confused. Each cell in our bodies is subject to a death sentence if you don't get enough oxygen and if you don't get enough food in the organism. That is not going to happen with your computer. You power it and it will go. So that's the big difference.
And we will go to more of your calls. Let's go to Shubuda. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
So I have two questions. What is the difference in brain and mind? And is there a physical location to mind, or is it just an abstract term?
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Very interesting. Factually, if you are considering mind and brain, you have to start by considering that they are different things. But then when you start thinking through what the brain does in its work, you realize, if you have my position...
Thinking through with your brain or your mind?
Thinking through with your mind in your brain, you realize that your brain is producing your mind. So you have a relationship that is one of factory and product. The brain is the producer of a very special process you call mind, which allowed you to think certain thoughts, to transform them into words, to tell them into a microphone, and allows me to hear them and decode them in the inverse order. So what the brain is a producer of many things, such as motion, movements, but also a producer of something that is much more difficult to appreciate, which is the possibility of having an idea, of having a representation. So that's the relationship. Brains produce minds.
Again, our guest is Antonio Damasio. His new book, Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain. And on we go to Calistoga. Frederick, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. This week, practitioners of Zen and Buddhism and mindfulness are celebrating next Thursday on December 8th, a young prince, this is before Christ, experienced non-separation, and he became known as the Buddha, meaning conscious or awake. And I wanted to ask you, Professor Damasio, about this cosmology of Eastern and Buddhist understanding of non-separateness, that really our organs of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and the faculties that are associated with them, you know, sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and objects of mind, they are absolutely interdependent upon that which each of those faculties is in relationship, well, supposedly outside of ourselves. But is that thing that we see and is that thing that we hear actually really separate from us in relationship with those organs and the faculties? And there is where Buddhists experience some degree of freedom and liberation in this understanding of non-separateness.
Very good. Thank you so much. Let me answer by telling you, well, of course, I'll have to start by saying that I am a neurologist and neuroscientist. I am not, unfortunately, an expert on what you probably are, which is Buddhism. And I know a little bit about it, but I wish I would know more to give you a more informed answer. However, I can tell you, and I've discussed this with Buddhist friends of mine, I think that there's a level of process in our brains which which yields the primordial self, something that I talked about earlier in the hour, and primordial feelings, which are feelings that are attached to nothing but sheer existence, life in the body. And I think that they get extremely close, and some of my friends agree, with some of the states, for example, that you can achieve in Buddhist meditation, when you literally free yourself of the huge baggage of sensory information, of thought processes, of problems and preoccupations that you have about the world around. So you end up being focused entirely in your internal world, and that internal world gives you a vision of something else which we normally do not have available, because we are, as a result of the structure of our brains, too much focused on the outside world and on the problems that it generates for us.
People do meditation. I mean, it brings them onto another level of consciousness, or can potentially.
Exactly.
I'm also reminded of the work that Daniel Goleman has done on emotional intelligence in conjunction with the Dalai Lama. And there's a lot of study about mindfulness. In fact, the word is very key here.
Very key, yeah.
Thank you for that call. We'll go to some more calls in just a moment. I want to go to some of your emails. Mark writes, it sounds like your guest is saying that there are not different varieties of consciousness, but a singular one that is shared by all living creatures, the only question being degree. Can your guest describe his feelings on the level of consciousness called enlightenment? This is a good segue from talking about Buddhism. Is it a higher level or merely a return to a basic state of direct experience?
That's a wonderful question, and you know, it really gets you into an intellectual game of how you position these concepts spatially. I was just thinking in the previous question and answer, when I think of primordial feelings, in a way, I can describe them as a higher state. You know, it's something that is extremely pure, as I described earlier, unvarnished, unbalanced. It simply has to do with life ticking away inside an organism. And at the same time, when you look about it, when you look at it from a perspective of a neuroscientist, you're not going up. You're actually going down, because you're going into the brainstem, which is one of the oldest brain representatives of the life process and of the regulation of the life process in any species. So here we have the paradox. On the one hand, we're going up into something that is, from an intellectual standpoint, more refined. At the same time, physiologically, you're actually going deeper and deeper into the structure. But, you know, that's the marvel of having to think about these problems.
Another caller, listener, I should say, DB writes, I use a guide dog. It seems that both of us have some contribution to make to the study of the mind. Are not the mental maps I create different than maps created by the sighted? And what about the maps and the autobiography my dog creates as we navigate the world together?
Wonderful question. That allows me to say something that is implicit and very clear in my writings, but sometimes when you use words like maps and images, may not be clear if you don't go through all the criteria. When I use the word image as generated by a neural map, I am not talking necessarily about a visual image. In fact, I am not talking at all about visual images only. I'm talking about visual, auditory, olfactory, somatosensory. So somebody who is born blind and does not produce visual images is producing a slew of images of many other sensory stripes. Somebody who is born deaf does not produce auditory images, but produces all the other kinds. You are, as a non-visual, a non-sighted person, a rich producer of mind with all those other modalities. And all those other modalities, because, of course, your brain was not created new for you. Your brain is the result of a long evolutionary process. There are relationships between the kinds of image that you would have produced if you would be able to see, and the images, for example, that are produced in your somatosensory system, images that have to do with your body, with the structure of your muscles, with the structure of movement, and with the structure of sound within three-dimensional space. So all of those things, fortunately for all of us, come to be integrated, and if one is missing one of those stripes of imaging, as it were. It doesn't mean that you're impoverished in the sense that, of course, you don't have access to the visual kind in your particular case, but that doesn't mean you cannot compensate for it.
In fact, the other ones become more compensatory, don't they?
You compensate, and you do so in very, very rich ways, yeah. And you do it in fact, you can even lose two senses and still compensate for it beautifully. There's only one thing that you cannot miss, and this is very important for all the listeners, is that if you lose the sense of your body, then all bets are off. You can lose the sense of hearing, you can lose the sense of sight, you can lose both, you can lose olfaction, you can lose taste, but you cannot lose the sense of body. And that is sending you, it's one of those things that is there as a fact and that people hardly ever comment on, is that there's nobody that is born without having a representation of the body. It's an impossibility, because if that would be the case, you would die. You would not be able to regulate the state of your body.
We'll go to some more calls in just a moment. One more email, though. This is from Shirley, who says, when you speak of memories of anticipated future, can creating positive images, self-hypnosis about positive outcomes, instead of worry, change the outcome?
Wonderful question. I love it. And the answer is yes, and yes, and yes. In fact, it's one of the, I would say that, you know, among many of the good things that civilizations can bring, one good thing in our civilization is that we need to realize that how we conceive of our future and how we allow the future literally to pull us forward into it makes all the difference.
So Norman Vincent Peale was right. The power of positive thinking is real.
Absolutely. You know, I have a great mentor and friend, and that was Jonas Salk. And Jonas Salk constantly said, think positively. And then, of course, he would make a joke with a song and say, accentuate the positive. And, we had wonderful conversations, and sometimes I would call him with a big problem and something terrible had happened. Somebody had done something that he or she shouldn't. And he would say, dear boy, accentuate the positive. Forget about it.
Well, without sounding negative, I think there are probably young listeners out there who probably don't even know who Jonas Salk was. He discovered the cure for polio. He was one of my heroes, of course.
Yeah, just a minor thing.
A very minor thing, right? We go to more calls.
He just eradicated a disease from the face of the earth.
A disease that is featured in Philip Rosner's novel Nemesis, that really brings it in a very, unfortunately, palpable way back. Todd, join us, please. You're on the air.
Yes, I was recalling experiences taking an college drawing class, and it was interesting to note that when people were talking, they tend not to draw well. They drew what they interpreted, not what they saw. But when people began drawing well, when they were in the midst of it, speaking seemed difficult for them, as if they were working in a whole different part of their brain.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting, and it has all sorts of interesting correlates in neuroscience. For example, I don't think anybody has done the definitive study on it, but it is a fact that there's a very large number of visual artists, people that are fantastic draftsmen, great painters, architects, sculptors, who have actually very poor verbal abilities. And there's something to the fact that there is a distribution of brain talent, and that you can be extremely gifted in conceptualizing worlds in two dimensions, in three dimensions, non-verbally, and be extremely inarticulate about how to present, for example, what you're doing as an artist. There's also some impression that visual artists have a very high degree, incidence of dyslexia. So there's something to what you're saying, and what I think you're saying puts the finger on the following. We have different abilities generated in our brain by different systems, and sometimes for reasons that have to do with our genetics or with our early development, we end up giving more emphasis to one system than to the other.
I'm thinking about that phenomenon that they call synesthesia, where you have so many geniuses and so many artists who are synesthesiac.
Yeah, especially musicians. There's a very, very high prevalence of synesthesia, for example, in famous composers. For example, Ravel was a synesthete. So was Prokofiev, I think. I don't know about Shostakovich. But these are some of the people from recent times that we know for certain were synesthetes.
Let me get to another caller here, and that's you, Lee. Hi, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for the interesting discussion. Dr. DiMaggio, you say that the mind is created by the brain. Are you not concerned that by restricting the area that you're looking at in the organism as the brain, that you may miss, maybe a too restricted model, that, for instance, the fascial system or others are also contributing to what we consider the mind.
Which system? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Oh, the fascial system or, any other parts of the... If we carve up the body and look only at the brain and say the mind is a phenomenon only of the brain and not of the entire organism...
Listen, we're in entire agreement. When I say the brain, the nervous system, I'm being overly specific, and what I'm really saying is the following. If you don't have the brain, I don't think that you're going to have the mind. However, one of the things that I say in Self Comes to Mind, I think that's chapter 2, is to tell readers that the problems, the solutions, and the form of operation of living organisms prior to the existence of brains was already extremely similar to the one that you end up with brains. And in fact, one of the conclusions that I have in the book is that a conscious mind ends up discovering what was there before rather than creating new things. For example, consciousness does not create life regulation. Consciousness discovers that we have life regulation. It was there before. So I entirely agree. It's a product of the organism, not a product of the brain. But as a brain researcher, I need to concentrate on the brain.
Well, good to end on a note of agreement. Thank you so much for being with us, Antonio DiMaggio. The book, Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain. We return with Todd Gitlin in the next hour. I hope you'll join us for that. Thank you for being here this morning with us in this first hour. We appreciate your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.